New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to this new episode of New Books in Economics. I'm your host, Andrea Bernardi from Oxford Brookes University, and today I'm here with another host of the channel, which is Carlo D'Ippoliti from Sapienza University of Rome. And we're here to present a book where Carlo is also one of the co-editors. Another co-editor is Jan Kregel, but also we are here with Marcella Corsi, professor of economics here at Sapienza University of Rome, the third co-author of a book which I shouldn't define as a book of history of economic thought. Rather, I'm told by the co-editors that this should be named, should be called, should be defined a history of economic ideas. So welcome, Carlo and Marcella. Let's start with a brief introduction of your background and your current affiliations.
So I'm professor of economics at Sapienza University of Rome. I'm a PhD in economics from Manchester University, UK. And I'm actually involved in history of economic ideas since my graduation. And then I've been involved in several studies concerning innovation theory, development, and now gender economics mostly.
I'm Carlo D'Ippoliti. I'm also based at Sapienza University of Rome. And in fact, I'm a former PhD student of Marcella's. And I'm also the editor of the PSL Quarterly Review and an Italian journal called Moneta e Credito.
Very good. So let's start, because this is a very, very complex book. And the title is Classical Economics Today, Essays in Honor of Alessandro Roncaglia. So we need to start probably with something about Alessandro Roncaglia, because probably not everybody knows among our listeners.
Well, Alessandro Roncaglia is probably one of the main historian of economic ideas, as a matter of fact. This is the definition that he will give on himself, I hope, actually. He graduated in Rome, the University La Sapienza, under the supervision of a great Italian economist of the past, but not so far away, actually, in terms of time, Paolo Silos Labini. And since then, he studied the classical economist with the idea of discovering the contemporary value of the ideas developed by these classical authors through time. Everything starts actually with William Petty. He is one of the first writers on William Petty, Economic Arithmetics. Then he moved to several authors that are actually also discussed in this volume, so Turgot, for example, but mostly Adam Smith and the relationship between Adam Smith and the contemporary economics. This is something that came out from the Silos Labini tradition. Paolo Silos Labini used to call Adam Smith my friend Adam. And he used to teach economics, starting really from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. One of the main books by Alessandro Roncaglia is The Wealth of Ideas, just to give you a link between the inheritance, the Adam Smith inheritance, and his contribution to economics.
And we have here a picture of Adam Smith. Probably let's start with the cover of the book, because there are three, six, seven pictures of very important economists. So perhaps you can tell us who they are and what is the relationship between them and classical economics.
Well, let me first say that I'm very fond of this cover because it was done by my daughter. So it's somehow a family a gift to Alessandro Roncaglia. My daughter just graduated in architecture, and she was very proud to be involved in the design of this cover. That is basically a summing up of the main classical contribution through time. We start really with Adam Smith and Turgot, Then we move to David Ricardo, just in the middle between the two. Then, of course, we reach half 19th century with Karl Marx and John Stuart Mill. And then we come up with the 20th century with John Maynard Keynes and Piero Sraffa. So in that sense, the choice of the authors are also related to the time passing of the discipline from political economy to economics. So in that sense, the ideas have changed, the methodologies have changed, and Alessandro Roncaglia has dedicated most of his life really to describe these changes.
And you told me earlier that the presence of Keynes here is somehow controversial, but
yes,
we can say what is the relationship between the classic themes and what came after him.
Perhaps. Yeah. As a matter of fact, Keynes became an economist. I say became because he was not an economist at first, but became an economist under the Marshallian tradition. He was always based in Cambridge, and there, of course, the Marshallian tradition was basically the rule. Being Marshallian in that sense meant to know very well the classical theories, especially the one related to the division of labor, the impact of the division of labor on economic growth and productivity. Marshall dedicated quite a lot of time and space also in his principles on the debate about divisional labor and the increased return slow and so on. And so in that sense, he was very conscious of the classical tradition, but at the same time, he was already formed with the new methodologies belonging to the economic tradition. And again, I stress the change between and the transition from the political economy in the classics and economics in the Marshallian and then Gigunzians and so on tradition, so the new classical or marginalist tradition. So Keynes is controversial in that sense, but is also a sort of bridge between the past and the present. In my view, but especially in the view of Alessandro Roncaglia, in the several contributions that he has written about Keynes, especially about probability in Keynes, for example, one of his articles on Keynes was really about the concept of uncertainty and probability in Keynes. So according to Roncaglia and according also to us, Keynes in that sense can be considered, Keynes' theory can be considered as a way of looking at the classical tradition with new glasses or under a new perspective. So that's why we really think it's well placed in this book in honor of Alessandro.
Well, if I may add... You could also read the title of our book, Classical Economics Today, implying that we are not just interested in the reconstruction of what people in the past have said, but also in trying to understand how can we apply some of their teaching, how can we try to build a different way of doing economics. Therefore, classical is also very much of a modern approach, in which Keynes, of course, has a very large role to play.
For the non-economists that are listening, what they should know about the relationship between classical economics, neoclassical economics, and also the heterodox versus orthodox debate?
Well, one of Alessandro's most important contributions, as Marcella said, is The World of Ideas, in which he tries to reconstruct the history of economic thought as basically a competition, if you want, between two ways of looking at the market. You could think of the market as a point in time and space where people come, they meet, those who wish to buy have some money, and we don't know where does this money come from, or those that wish to sell have product that are ready, you know, produced, ready to be sold, and again, we don't ask where this stuff coming from. They meet, exchange, and never see again. And this is what basically is the archetypal idea or vision of what we call neoclassical economics. This is very much a simplistic, or well, a simple way of looking at the economy that was developed towards the end of the 19th century, and is today the dominating way of looking at the economy.
The mainstream, let's say so.
Yeah.
Mainstream economics.
Mainstream economics,
yeah.
Yes. But between ups and downs, there have always been also another way of looking at things, that is thinking of the economy as a network of repeating transactions between producers, for example. A lot of goods and services that are everyday produced are not meant to be sold to final consumers, but rather to other firms. Therefore, you have a whole network of relations, repetitive relations, that accumulate over time and that give you a completely different view of the economy. If you're looking for an archetypal vision, you could think, for example, of the relation between towns and countryside in medieval times, or today between the global north and the global south. What we are really talking about a repetition of production. And why this is the most distinctly classical way of looking at the economy. What is important here is that if you're considering the marketplace, as I was referring to before, the mainstream way of looking at the economy, what you really care about is that supply for a specific good has to be the same of demand, and it will be the price, the market price, to adjust in order to reach this sort of equilibrium. If instead you take the other way of looking at things, the classical approach, what you really care about is the sustainability of the system, the capacity of the economy to reproduce over time. In a sense, you know, the decades or now centuries long question of how is it that we can wake up in the morning and have everything that we need, even though society is based on the division of labor. So it's two very different ways of looking at the economy. Alessandro tried to argue that you could create a whole narrative of how in the history of economic thought these two approaches have, you know, can come to dominate one or the other over time. Of course, if we choose this title for our book, is that because we are not unbiased, we have our own preference, hopefully based on solid arguments though.
Of course. Allow me to say something more, especially for the non-economists. You are certainly aware of the relationship among social classes. There has been a large debate on inequality also because of, or in any case, after the financial crisis, the recent financial crisis. So social classes were really important for classical economists. When Adam Smith started writing his Wealth of Nations, he had clear in mind, and he was actually seeing, because he always used this verb, I see, I observe, I monitor somehow, we would say today, the development of a new society. And he was curious enough to try to explain the rules in this new society as a philosopher, because he would define himself as a philosopher, not certainly as an economist, because economics didn't exist, of course, as a political science or a social science at that time. So in that sense, he was really trying to picture how the society was changing because of the Industrial Revolution. In that sense, it was crucial for the classical economists to link the social class structure with the development of the science, but also with the development of the economic ideas. So, for example, the concept of price for the classical economists is strictly linked to the concept of value. And value is based on labor. And labor corresponds somehow with the social class, the class, of course, of the workers, the working class, which is, by the way, in competition, I would say so, inverted commas, with the class of the capitalist. And the two of them are again in competition with a third class. This is the one of the rentiers. So, of course, what it was left of the of feudalism with the noble class declining into a new form of class that was the rentiers class. So, in that sense, even the concept of prices was coming out of the interaction between the three classes, and all the productive system that Carlo was referring before was strictly connected with the societal structure that the classical were trying to describe. In that sense, discipline was political. You could avoid to discuss about economic ideas without or ignoring the struggle even for the functional distribution of income, so for the distribution of income on these three classes. The two things were strictly interconnected. And after Marx, they became so interconnected to become dangerous for the bourgeoisie. So in that sense, especially with Marshall and with Jevons, who introduced the concept of marginal utility, and then, of course, that was the beginning of marginalism, also in terms of methodology and the link between economics and mathematics, that nowadays is the rule, unfortunately, somehow. So in that sense, politics was somehow cancelled in order to make economics more acceptable for the new powers. And the new powers, of course, were the ones who were finally leading the game or ruling the game. So the capitalist, of course, as nowadays, it still is.
Well, so well, there was a very complex task to deal with in this
book.
Absolutely. Let's see how did you achieve it through the structure of the contributions. So maybe we should say something about the contributors and the contents now.
Indeed, yes. Very quickly, we have tried to... Well, there are two main aims here. First of all, to put together quite a lot of authors who had an important role in Alessandro Roncaglia's life, because in any case, this book is full of love for Alessandro Roncaglia and gratitude somehow and friendship. So Jan Kregel, Mariton Veronachi, Michele Salvati, Salvatore Biasco, but also Gianni Vaggi and Geoffrey Harcourt had a very important role in Alessandro's life through time. Geoffrey Harcourt is certainly one of the most famous post-Keynesian economics, as Jan Kregel is. Jan Kregel worked together with Alessandro in Cambridge when Alessandro studied with Sraffa. And Mariton Veronachi and Michele Salvati and Salvatore Biasco were very much linked with Alessandro, because Michele Salvati and Salvatore Biasco both were Paolo Silo Slabini fellow, somehow the one before Alessandro in terms of time. And Mario Tomberonachi was actually the co-author of Alessandro in many works, especially when they were particularly young, because they met in Cambridge, they studied together and so on. So the first group of contributors were really part of Alessandro Roncaglia's life. Then, of course, there are the others, somehow the youngest, Carlo and I, first of all, who worked with him. Carlo is now editing the journals who were edited by Alessandro for all his life, basically. I'm actually chairing I'm having the chair, actually, that was before of Paolo Silo Sabini and then of Alessandro Roncaglia, so in some ways I'm working on their steps. And but also the others, for example, Nerio Naldi, who has been working on Sraffa under the supervision of Alessandro, and then other young colleagues like David Antonioli and Paolo Pini. So also in this case, some of these chapters have been written like a sort of discussion with Alessandro on topics that not necessarily see the authors converging on similar ideas or similar opinions. Alessandro is very open to debate. You don't have to agree with him in order to work with him or to discuss with him. He's very happy to discuss also in sort of contradictions. So it was a sort of reconstructing a debate, the main aim of this book. Then, of course, There are some other contributors like Sergio Parinello, Maria Cristina Marcuzzo, Annalisa Rosselli, Bertram Scheffel, that had a link with Alessandro also from a teaching point of view, in a sense that, for example, Sergio Parinello was the one who organized the summer school in Trieste for a very long time. In that summer school, quite a lot of heterodox economists met regularly for many years, and Alessandro was one of them. Maria Cristina Marcuzzo and Annalisa Rosselli had always a very strong link with Alessandro, especially on the reconstruction of the Cambridge tradition. They are great experts of John Robinson, Kahn, and all the other members of the Keynes circle, let's say so, in Cambridge. And finally, Alfonso Sanchez Ormigo is Spanish, of course, as you can imagine from his name. And he worked with Alessandro quite a lot on the reconstruction of the classical Spanish thought that was almost forgotten, mainly during the Franco time, because, of course, there was a big fight against the so-called Ricardian socialist based in Spain. So, in any case, all of them were really part or somehow pieces of a big puzzle.
Wow, so we have only 7 pictures on the cover, but there are so many other pictures that we can try to visualize in this story. And maybe we can go now to chapter 5, which is your chapters, your own chapters on the democracies of ideas, John Stuart Mill, liberalism and the economic debate by Marcella Grossi and Carlo Di Politi.
Yes, well, we chose the topic of John Stuart Mill for several reasons. First of all, we both like Mill a lot, and it's really a pleasure to read, so I definitely suggest that everybody should at least read something of Mill. Then it's also one of the points on which we possibly do not fully agree with Alessandro Moncalia, because he sometimes hints at this traditional interpretation of Mill as, if you want, the author that started the corruption of the classical school, because he tried to innovate or insert some specific ideas that will later be used, you know, to develop the neoclassical approach that is today mainstream. But there's also a third reason, that is, I think that Mill is very well, the topic of which we talk in the chapter by Mill is very much related to the contemporary topic about pluralism in economics. If you want, we start from Mill as a liberal. He's very famous, you know, for his political philosophy. But something that most people do not realize, that history was very much mirrored at the time. And with an historical approach, Mill considers that in most in the most advanced countries of his time, tyranny has mostly given place to representative democracy. This should have been, in principle, a very wonderful achievement, but Mill was not satisfied yet. He saw a new stage of the risk of tyranny over society, and that is the tyranny of the majority, of course. He writes, for example, that self-government is not government of each by herself, but of each by all the rest of society. Basically, according to Mill, already at his time, individuals were lost in the crowd. And we can only think of what would he say if he could observe today's reality. Instead, he tries to develop a rational argument in favor of pluralism, of experimental different lifestyles, and most of all for tolerance. According to Mill, persecution is very effective. Wherever it was tried to persecute the heretical views, it almost always worked. Because he writes, for example, that it is a piece of sentimentality that the truth, merely as truth, had any inherent power denied to error. Therefore, according to Mill, we really had to try hard and make an explicit effort in trying not to persecute different views. This is, as I said, I don't want to tell you about what we write in the chapter because the readers will be...
you have to read it.
No, but it's what I think could be interesting for our listeners is that, in our view, Mill's arguments in defense of intellectual pluralism are very much relevant today because within economics, at least, there is really a war going on in several countries in which, this could be paradoxical if you want, but in which it is the state, the power of governments, that is being used in order to suppress pluralism and to promote a single view as the official and right way of doing economics. I'm referring, of course, to the various attempts as measuring the so-called quality of research that I perfectly agree in several disciplines make a lot of sense. I'm not saying that you can never evaluate research at all, but it just happens that in economics, given the disequilibrium, you know, the different power relations within the discipline, this is being used in several European but also non-European countries to really get rid of all the heterodox people and all those that hold views that do not fully correspond to the mainstream. This is, you know, if you want, even impoverishing the economic debate itself. It's also a pity for mainstream people who should be instead more interested in knowing more and defending their own approach if they really think it is the right one. The idea that, let me use this, you know, not properly precise term, but the idea that free market economists try to use government power, you know, to win the battle of ideas is really scary.
But this book is somehow what I should suggest to friends of mine who not only are not economists, but they might have a very wrong idea of what economics is. So this book is exactly on what they wouldn't expect in a textbook or in a book of economics. So this is another reason to buy it. Although we had a podcast interview with you, Carlo, with the authors of a new handbook, and this was a handbook of microeconomics, and the title was Microeconomics of Complex Economies. So earlier you mentioned that somehow the marginal revolution and then we shift to mathematics as a very important component of economics. So if this is the case, what is the relationship between classics, neoclassics, and the current notion of heterodoxy in economics? Let's map this for the non-economists.
Well, this is a very difficult question, and I can give you my opinion. Possibly even Marcella will have some different views, I don't know. Well, I would say that, first of all, it is, I think, the fact that not all heterodox people agree with the classical view, and this is just one of the several schools that, you know, disagree with the mainstream. There are some scholars, even, you know, very prominent ones, for example, Lawson, that argue that the main difference between mainstream and heterodox economists should be sought in the use of mathematics. I personally disagree with this. Because, for example, if you look through our own book today, there is quite a lot of mathematics, especially when it comes to Zrafkan economics, which is, you know, the modern contemporary approach to the classical theory of prices that requires a good deal of mathematics. I did some of it at the time of my PhD, but I still, you know, remember it with some suffering because there is heavy stuff going on there. So I don't think the mathematics is necessarily the dividing line, but of course, it's about how you use it. A few minutes ago, I was just mentioning that in my view, the vision, the archetypal way of how you think the economy works should be possibly the dividing line. If you have, you know, the marketplace view in which consumers and firms or producers meet, or instead, if you have this web of transactions view, some people could have other different views. In fact, what could be recognized is that heterodox economics at the moment is more of a sociological category. I mean, a group of people that meet at conferences, that share some interests, that are dissatisfied with the current state of the economic debate because it's too narrow, but they do not necessarily agree on each and every point of theory. But that is part of the beauty of it, I think. I mean, pluralism should be about debating. It's called research because we don't yet know all the answers, otherwise it wouldn't. The point is, how do you define, you know, ways for, let me come back to Mill, to define a moral way of debating, respecting the other people's view, arguing for your own, because pluralism is not the same as saying anything goes, but surely not trying to suppress minority views.
Yes, diversity then. I mean, it should be recognized that or at least, I mean, in my view, it should be stressed that to be heterodox means, firstly, to believe in history, or better, to believe that all economic models are historically determined. And therefore, when you study, develop, or teach models, economic models, you always have to warn either your coders or your students that what you are teaching them must always be compared with the reality, and you have to avoid the risk or minimize, let's say so, the risk that the reality is confused with what the models is actually depicting. It's exactly the opposite. A model should try to describe a reality that is by definition much more complex than the one that the model is able to describe, or of course to explain somehow. So in that sense, the link between history and economics is definitely something that brings into being a more complex methodology, a more complex set of ideas. A pluralist point of view is crucial, but is, as I said before, it's really crucial, the concept of diversity. And diversity in this sense can be spelled out in many different directions. So it's diversity in terms of different methodologies. So in these books, for example, we have some contributions referring to the Zrafian methodology that is not just the theory of prices, but is something related, for example, with the static versus dynamic way of describing the reality. It concerns the concept of democracy in many different ways. So there is a sort of methodological approach that is not just the one of Zrafa, but of many classical authors described, that is reinforcing this idea of diversity. And it's also helping heterodox economists in dealing with diversity, which, by the way, is not an easy task. We are all aware of it.
Well, let's say, what is your next project, and what is possibly the future of classical economics? So what should we expect for the future?
Well, this is our challenge every day. This is what we try to do since the beginning. I mean, this was certainly the challenge of Paolo Silos Labini, who, by the way, wrote in one of his last books, was really saying something similar to what we are trying to say now or today. Actually, the title in Italian was Torniamo ai Classici, and by the way, the choice of classical economics today was also somehow a way of quoting or reestablishing a link with that contribution that was just written in Italian, I'm afraid, so was not available for English readers. Then it was a challenge and somehow for Alessandro Roncaglia and this exploration of the classical authors in terms of ideas. For us, the challenges are even more complex because we live in an educational system that is more and more, as Carlo was already saying, focused on measuring the quality of our teaching, of our writings, somehow standardizing our ideas. So the challenge of diversity that I mentioned before is the challenge that we try to to fight for every day. So the continuation of this work is working on heterodox methodologies and classical ideas in that sense.
Well, I might say the current system in Italy, but in several countries, really does not provide a lot of incentives to economists to write books. Yet it's extremely fun, so I'm sure we will try to do it even more in the future. Currently with Marcella, we are working on the impact of the European crisis, which unfortunately in some European countries is not over yet. Especially we look at it in terms of households' incomes, trying to look at the intersection of gender and class.
Yeah. We did it on poverty in a paper published by Feminist Economics, and now we are doing on gender and class with several contributions that we published in journals. But we hope to have a book eventually coming out on such a topic.
Good luck with this. By the way, the last question would be this one, if you allow me. With Wolfram Elsner, we said that complexity economics is already making impact because, for example, central banks are already adopting something new. Do you think that you are able to make an impact, if not with the central banks, but at least with students, so in training a new generation of economists with another sensitivity on the matter?
Well, first, it's true that I think central banks today are possibly much more open to new ideas than governments, for example. Possibly because, for example, in the European context, a much higher weight of responsibility to answer to the crisis was placed on central banks than on governments. I don't know, that could be a reason. But, for example, they are taking post-Keynesian views into account. Possibly they do not recognize it as such, but if you think, for example, of the works of Hyman Minsky, it's basically quite agreed today that financial turbulence can cause economic crises or at least recessions. And therefore, for example, they are already taking some hints into consideration. Sure, we do not expect to be called as the next governors, but it doesn't mean that our work doesn't have an impact.
No, absolutely. And in any case, one of the main messages of this book and of all our works, actually, in the latest years, is about plurality in methods, including history of economic thought. And we really think that plurality must be a deliberate choice for every kind of economic agent, individual or collective. Actually, in the preface to this book, we quoted a sentence by Salvatore Biasco, so chapter one, that if you allow me, I would just like to read because it's really a great synthesis of what we had tried to do in this contribution. He wrote, "At the base of a non-mainstream way of looking at the economy, from a descriptive and normative perspective, cannot be but social complexity, uncertainty, and innovative dynamics. Through these lenses, the aggregate behavior of the economy is studied as determined by constantly evolving endogenous events, which are fed by a number of driving forces, unstable and potential explosive relationship, non-deterministic developments, a financial system, so mentioning the central bank, closely interconnected to the real economy, but also able to acquire an autonomous dimension, and the social dynamic, so which brings back, of course, social classes, that changes in parallel to the whole process and that at the same time affects it." So I think this is, in synthesis, what we are trying to build on.
Thank you very much for your time, but also thank you very much for your work and for your contribution that you are truly making. So this is a book that I suggest everybody to buy as soon as possible, and it was published in 2018 by Anthem Press. So this is Classical Economics Today, Essays in Honor of Alessandro Roncaglia, edited by Marcella Corsi, Jan Kregel, and Carlo Lippoliti. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.